these questions came this morning. When a practice is given that has to do with the heart, which of the four is the default heart to concentrate on if it is not specified in the instructions? That's a very good question. Default, I like that question. Default. Yes, well, in Murshid's terminology, the heart is understood to denote a complex of four interrelated centers. Or you could say three, and the third having a double function. So in the Lataif system, the first comes the Latifa Qalbiya on the left side, then the Latifa Ruhiya on the right side, and then in the center, Latifa Sirriya. But Murshid explains this middle center as a double center, speaks of four quarters of the heart. And Pirulait has elaborated on that by explaining how the receptive aspect of the solar plexus complements the expressive aspect of the center of the chest. And as we continue with the practice of the symbol, we will put this into practice. So this morning we began with two sides of the heart, the left and right, and the plumes that radiate from these, becoming like wings. And what remains then is to go into the sir with its two parts, the passive or jamali part and the active or jalali part. And all of this is symbolized in the Sufi symbol of the winged heart. That is the picture of the anatomy of the heart. The two wings indicating the qalb and ruh, and the crescent and the star designating the sir in its two aspects. So, furthermore, Murshid explains that the most fundamental dimension of the heart is in the middle. However, one approaches it through the side. First through the physical heart, which is the most tangible, most available. It already has our attention. And then one works one's way from there. You start on the left, then naturally, if you're on the left to begin with, as a counterbalance, you've got to proceed then to the right. And when you've gone to the right, then you have these two poles, and then you see what is there in between. And that itself has its lower and upper chambers, which are the passive chamber, which is like a vacuum found in the solar plexus, and the chamber in the chest, which is like a, I'd say like a volcano, eruptive and isn't radiant, molten. So one begins with the physical heart, or the subtle organ within the physical heart. But even, I would say, to be careful not necessarily to begin with the physical heart. Because oftentimes a person is in an agitated state or a fragile state, and the heart itself is not a safe place. The heart could be volatile, could be pained. Of course, our intention is not to avoid pain, but you have to go slowly and build support, build a foundation. So before going into the heart, beginning with the belly makes good sense. Latifa nafsiya. It's really the foundation of the heart. When you've built strength there, then you can start to enter the heart. And in fact, more often, the very best thing to do is to begin with the feet. Start on the ground. Start where you stand or where you sit and build up. So the feet, and then tailbone. In the practice this morning of the Bij Mantras, elemental ascent, we worked through the canonical, let's say, most orthodox form of the chakras, and which begins identifying the, sometimes the Muladhara is identified with the tailbone, but in fact, more often than not, it's actually the perineum, which is between the rectum and the generative organ. So that's something that Moshe also warns a bit about. He said, that's an advanced practice, because of course it also relates to sexuality, and so to arouse that energy without containment or sufficient familiarity with the whole living system of one's subtle anatomy could be reckless. So really the most foundational grounding sites preceding the heart center on the left are the feet and the belly. And when the heartbeat gets rhythmic and it's entrained in tandem with the breath, the circulatory and respiratory systems are working together. There's an ease and expansion. Then that leads naturally. Then one starts to shift from the left to the right into this subtler domain. But one needn't go too fast from one to the other. So that was an important question, thank you. Please share the intonation sounds through the chakras and review the symbols in the elemental ascent. Do we have it written down? Yes, you do. Okay, so you can refer to that. At the time this question was given, probably wasn't available, but you have that, so do refer to it. Now here's a question about the same practice, the elemental ascent. I noticed there was a difference in the placement of the chakras in the elemental ascent, as I taught it this morning, versus the practice that we just did. So it's worth just noting that. Of course, within yoga, there are different strands that variously identify the positions of the chakras, but here reference to the Manipura. Manipura in the elemental ascent is in the navel, and so in this system, the solar plexus would be understood as the Anahata, as part of this twofold Anahata chakra, which means there are two chakras right down at the root of the body, so to speak, the perineum, and then the pelvis. And the second one is right in the pelvis, and then thirdly the Manipura, which is in that position that we in the Sufi system identify as the Latifa Nafsiya. So the question is, can you please clarify the Manipura, fire element triangle in the third phase of the practice? Then we focus on the Manipura, and that's connected with the fire element. And a wonderful, good question is, which way does it point? Is the tip of the triangle pointing down or up? And I'll tell you, I had kept it ambiguous purposefully, but I'll explain why. Because there are two different traditions in this regard, and I would let you each just find your own solution. But in yoga, the triangle points down. It does. So the top is flat across, and then the point is down. But in the Hermetic tradition, the triangle representing fire has its point up. And Moshe doesn't specify in his directions. He says only a red. He also kept it ambiguous, a red triangle. So I would leave it to you to determine which one you use. I'll tell you, I've been doing it with the pointer using the Western method, which has a certain kind of very obvious logic to it, because a flame appears that way. Thank you. Oh yeah, that's another ambiguous one. That's good. Why, for ether breath, sometimes today we breathe in and out of both nostrils and mouth, and in the Risala booklet, I'm glad that the booklet is still sometimes referred to, it is said to be in and out of the nose only. That's right. Well, the elemental breaths are a practice that we mostly know through oral tradition. There's one, as far as I know, one original record of the practice, but it's so simple, and it doesn't even refer to the elements. There's an archival document, the Nekbat Foundation, apparently from Moshe's time, of 20 breaths of purification, bless you. 20 breaths, five of each of the four. Not mentioning earth, water, fire, and air, but in through the nose, out through the nose, in through the mouth, nose, out through the mouth, etc. Just those 20 breaths. And so no mention of ether breath. And yet, of course, the purification breaths are well known through oral tradition. And so there has been some ambiguity about the ether breath, and I have known it to be taught in two different ways. One is returning simply to breathing through the nose, but now, of course, the whole vibration of the breath is very different and extremely refined. But otherwise, it's a return to the ordinary way of breathing, which is through the nose, but very subtleized. And then there's another way that's come down, that's been taught over the years, which is to breathe at the same time through the nose and the mouth. And for my own part, years ago I focused on the first method, just only breathing through the nose. But in more recent years, I've inclined toward the latter method and found that also very helpful, very valuable. So there is no means, as far as I know, of historically verifying what Moshe had intended, or even if he had specified an ether breath at all. There are no documents showing that, only the 20 breaths. So also when I come to the ether breath, I don't think of it as something to necessarily be done in the same, symmetrical number of five. Just breathe for some time in ether, whereas the others are matched up numerically. The ether breath is just a deep relaxation at the end. And whether you do that just through the nose or through the nose and the mouth, these are both ways that have come down. That's all I can really say about that. And then the last question is about the repetitions of the divine names Ahad and Samad, and onward we'll come to some further names in the practice of the symbol. It depends if one is doing the full practice, which takes more time, or a more abbreviated version. And this morning we did the full version, and in fact we haven't done the whole practice yet. We haven't had the time for that yet, but we will. So in the full version, one intones each of the names 101 times, and in the abbreviated version, just 31 times. So that makes it easier, because this is a wonderful practice to do every day, and you might have also a number of other practices that you do. And so a streamlined version, doing 31 repetitions for each of these divine names, means that one can keep the practice succinct. But it's also wonderful to do the full litany. So I appreciate these questions. And do feel free, I encourage you, over the coming days, if something is not clear or you have a particular special question, then do write it down and we'll keep going. Well, we just touched upon how, the esoteric school, we are inheritors of multiple, complex, evolving esoteric traditions transmitted down the ages, which include grand, deriving from the Middle Eastern monastics, the Hanifs and the Jews and the Christians of the Mediterranean and the Arabian Peninsula, and a strand of Greco-Egyptian Hermeticism. There are shamanic currents from Central Asia. There is a Vajrayanic inflection through Khorasan. And then there is yoga, particularly the Hatha Yoga of the Natapantis. All of these lineages have intertwined in the history of Sufi esotericism. And these lineages themselves are diverse oftentimes in their various schools and methods. So we mentioned how the different yogic systems, the chakras are placed somewhat differently. Also, the lataif are understood differently by different Sufi thinkers, even within a single lineage. For instance, what we call the sir is sometimes called the ru, and what they call the ru is sometimes called the sir. So different terminologies and also different identification of colors. So one cannot force all of the systems into one system, but one can identify common themes and, moreover, syncretization or the development of practices by building upon those common themes through inner exploration and realization, provides us with a repertoire of practices in which there is no final and ultimate color sequence, but we have an array of practices that utilize colors sequentially in methods that are internally consistent. So the practice that we did this morning well, the practice of the early morning, the four manifestations, follows a classically Sufi progression of colors. Red, which is associated with the qalb, white, which is associated with the ruh, yellow, sometimes gold, sometimes yellow, and then black. But that isn't the only sequence that is traditional, and in fact those very same colors are ranged in a different sequence in Greco-Egyptian alchemy, which entered into Sufi alchemy through Ja'far as-Sadiq, the great Imam, and through Jabir ibn Hayyan. And that Greco-Egyptian alchemy goes back to very early sources. It goes back to the old Egyptian books. And those sources reflect a contemplation on the course of the day, beginning with the black of night and on to the white of day and further on to what we call the golden hour, when the sun is descending toward the horizon, that horizontal light that bathes everything in a warm golden hue, and then sunset itself, which glares red. So that sequence is fundamental in Greco-Egyptian alchemy and on into Sufi alchemy and on into the Hermetic alchemy of Europe in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. Black, white, yellow, red. And alchemy has been called by its practitioners down the ages sometimes the work of a day. So the practice that we'll enter into now takes this approach. But pursues these associations in connection with the planets, the primary planets connected with these colors and their temperaments, producing a, and their elements producing a movement of thought and feeling. That is linked also with a sequence of divine names which have come down in the Chishti tradition. So we have here colors, planets, humors, and divine names, all ranged according to this fourfold movement of classical alchemy. Now color, we've already started to work with color. Color is very important in alchemy. Color is very important in Sufism. There's a verse in Surah Baqarah in the Quran that says, "The color of God. What is more beautiful than the color of God?" And we are God's worshippers. Color of God. purest, the truest, the ultimate color, the encompassing color, the color of which all hues are shades. That great color of colors, to climb to which we have to ascend the rungs of the rainbow. In one practice, we might ascend from red to white to yellow to black. In another, black to white to yellow to red. But in all of these operations, we are tinctured. The Hadith Qudsi says, God has 70,000 veils of light and darkness. There's 70,000 colors, actually. And to move past a veil, you must move through the veil. And so the journey to God is prismatic, passing through all of these vibrations, all of these hues. In the Chishtiya, color is very important. A famous song of Amir Khusro goes, Aaj rang hai, today is color. Today there is color. Rang. Rang is hal. Rang, one's color, is one's state. You are your color. Frequency of your subtle body, the wave of your mind. So dye yourself. Why did Hazrat Nizamuddin love to play holi? You know holi? Yeah. Throwing dye? Holi is the very symbol of the path, these flying colors, and dyeing oneself in the powder thrown from the hand of one's murshid. In quest of the Sibghatullah, the color of God. So this is some of the theory behind some of what we're doing. And of course it's already so well known to you in many ways. You, I'm sure, are familiar with the nature meditations of Murshid, which he evokes the meanings and poetic and spiritual evocations of the colors. Once a man came to Murshid and said he was seeing colors at different times, and Murshid asked him to keep a log of the colors that he saw. And then at this just the same time, that man read a book about the Mahatmas, the hidden masters. And he came and said, these colors, they must be hidden masters coming to me. And Moshe gently walked him through his log and walked him through his state and what he had been doing and what was going on in his life when he had seen these colors. And he saw that these colors were not some entity that came to him from outside. These colors were the description of his own inner state, welling up, manifestations of his own inner being, in accord with his tenor, the pitch to which he was tuned. Moshe had helped him to see that coloration unfurling in his life. So there are two ways that color can be worked with, and this is really true of all Sufi practice, which is there is always both a descriptive aspect and a prescriptive aspect. So the descriptive aspect means witnessing your own state as it is, being present to what is here, what is arising, rather than being distracted. It's witness. What is my color this morning? What state is here? Be attentive to one's inner being, condition of your body, condition of your mind, condition of your heart. But the other dimension is prescriptive, which means that by visualizing something, one can evoke it, one can make it more present. So one might aspire to a certain color, one might be given by one's guide a color to work with, to visualize. Or sometimes the visualization is to visualize a color, then turning into another color. That concentration develops a inner focus and vividness of attention and the ability to create with, as what Moshe describes as mental atoms, to paint the picture of one's own mind. How did the great painters do it? They had this knack. So we will work through these several days with color. Dye yourself, saturate yourself in that color. The whole atmosphere is tinted, and your aura is tinted, and you find yourself in a landscape of that color, imbuing you. And then, as it were, shining out through it is the color beyond it, suffusing it, and as the landscape shifts, the first color dissipates, fades, and the next color intensifies. And so 70,000 veils, light and darkness. And these colors will appear in your dreams also. Most probably they already are, but does one notice? You might find yourself in strange landscapes or underground in a cavern that glows. if the whole of a dream revolves around a thing, what is that thing? What is the color of that thing? There are so many signs of our coordinates in our passage from the finite to the infinite. See in the course of the day how a certain color has a certain effect on you. Certain phase of your life, you may need to surround yourself by certain colors. Repaint the walls. Wear a different shirt. So this is some orientation, and it's time, it's best, I think, to take a break for a little while now, have a stretch, and then when we come back, we can enter into the practice of the work of a day.